This week, investors chose the sidelines on U.S. dollar strength. Welcome back, everyone. Chris Walczak, your host, here again. Another big edutainment-packed show and two more top guests on this week's May 18th episode. Raghi Horner of Simpler Trading makes her show debut. Author of three books with decades of trading experience. She likes gold and the cryptocurrencies. And then part two with Bix Weir of Road to Ruta continues with our crypto revolution. And of course, Bix remains very bullish on the precious metals. And for my Bitcoin aficionados, you might find it interesting that Metcalfe's law evidently has been debunked. I try to outline just how, although maybe we're splitting hairs just a little bit here, when it comes to networks, Metcalfe's law of course holds that peer-to-peer networks are exponential functions based on the number of people within the network. In reality, it's much more logarithmic or even quadratic, an S-curve. So why is this so important? Well, so many people have built models on this concept that Bitcoin will continue to move exponentially. And we've seen that for several years, especially in 2017. Very dangerous assumption to make with some of these really lofty numbers tossed out there. So if you're interested, you can find more in this week's reports on the Alpha Stocks newsletter, as well as on the Nuggets webpage. And speaking of the Alpha Stocks newsletter, still running a special there. So if you haven't signed up yet, you can support the show. And wow, we could really use your support because our five-year-old is expecting a little brother, hopefully, in the next 2 months. So if you'd like to help support us and help us keep the Gold Seek Radio family growing, we'd certainly appreciate you as an Alpha Stocks subscriber. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Light cloud cover appeared over the precious metals as a stealth dollar rally kept safe haven investments under pressure amid soaring treasury note rates. Investors feared the threat of a more hawkish Fed. Less than savory trade talks between China and Washington soured the mood of investors. By Friday's close, gold was off only 30, though, finishing at $12.91. Silver gave back just about 30 cents, about 2%, ending at $16.45, while the XAU Precious Metals Shares Index was off $1.80, closing around 82. Black gold, though, bucked the trend, moving higher 67 cents, about 1%, finishing at $71.37, another multi-year record high above consolidation support, but having lost, I'd say, a little bit of upward momentum here. And my new consolidation forecast suggests a price move to 90, even 100, maybe as soon as this year. I wouldn't be surprised to see some consolidation before then. On to the Bitcoin ETF, GBTC, gave back 50 cents, 4%, closing at $13.53. And the Tezos pre-token futures added 25% in 1 week, as predicted in the last few reports. Moving on, the top story moving the markets this week, trade talks between the U.S. and China in Washington were mostly ambiguous on Thursday. News that China was offered a deal to reduce its trade surplus with the U.S. by $200 billion was rejected by officials. In related news, policymakers in Congress are voting on a bill that would grant officials even more power to block international deals with companies that might jeopardize national security. Investors remain concerned on potential trade wars and the impact on the markets. In other geopolitical news, North Korea called off high-level talks with South Korea, blaming the U.S. and South Korean military exercises. North Korean officials threatened to boycott the scheduled June 12th summit with the U.S. if Washington requires surrender of its nuclear weapons. Precious metals, bottom line. The U.S. dollar did put some downward pressure on the safe haven sector this week. Still, the 2009 pattern that sent us much higher does appear to be holding. Cloudy skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week as investors booked some profits from the two-week rally on concerns over the risk of rate increases. Plus, solid gains in crude oil did help buoy the market overall. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones had dropped just 116, just below the $25,000 psychological support, ending off 0.5% at 24,715. The S&P 500 gave back 15, about 0.5%, at 27,13, while the NASDAQ fell 50, just over 0.5%, ending at 73,54. Meanwhile, the 10-year U.S. Treasury note climbed to the highest point in about 7 years. The spread between the 10-year and the 2-year suggests a red-hot domestic economy, which might just force the Fed's hand on higher rates. Looking over at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the current Fed funds futures rate is holding steady at 1.75% until the next FOMC meeting slated for June 13th, where a quarter-point rate hike is expected with 100% probability. After the June hike, there are even odds of one more rate hike in December. Turning to shares in the news, one positive, shares of Deere & Company, ticker DE, added about 6% on neutral earnings news. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, the 7-indicator greed to fear index pendulum remains in the neutral category for the second week running, leaving plenty of room for upward price advances. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. Pleasure to welcome Rocky Horner here today to the show on her debut at Gold Seek Radio, professional trader. Welcome, Rocky.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you with us. And can you tell people just a bit about your background? And you've obviously, you know, helped an awful lot of people. You have at least 3 books with Wiley and Sons, all kinds of speaking engagements.
Now, I'm actually working on the 4th right now, so very excited about that. And I've been a trader for coming up on just over 3 decades now, so it's been an interesting evolution of watching where the markets were in the late 80s to where they sit now. And I've never been more excited about retail trading and where and what kind of access we have to multiple asset classes. So quite frankly, I trade it all, whether it's gold, whether it's crude. It just doesn't matter. If there's an opportunity and it's showing up on the charts, I want to play it.
You had some neat comments on the crypto space before the show. This is the future of finance as well as government and, frankly, blockchain. I mean, it's like rock and roll. I think it's here to stay. Give us any insights you might have on the topic.
Sure. I mean, right now up in New York, we've got about 8,500 people attending a conference. It's the largest one on the East Coast. And these people have paid $2,000 a ticket. And the reason I mention that is there is a small loyal following in cryptocurrency, but I think the error that most people make in the space is they buy into the fear about the cryptocurrency and it blinds them to the reality, which I think you and I are believers in, which is the blockchain. And it's not necessarily a one and the same discussion. You know, blockchain is where the future is. It may not necessarily be the crypto playing field we see right now, but there are going to be some winners that are emerging. And I think that anything other than accepting that this is an evolution of currency, I've been a Forex trader since, you know, 99, 2000, 2001. This to me is just the evolution of the foreign exchange, if you will.
You touched on this concern that people have whenever it's brought up, either it's ambivalence. It really just swings from one side of the pendulum to the other. It's so similar to the dot-com days with the internet revolution. Started off with Netscape, I think, was big back then, just starting to take off. I think this revolution might be just as large. It's sort of a Internet 3.0. Many of my top guests here believe that it's actually a technological leap well beyond the original Internet email and whatnot and voice over Internet. Give us your thoughts then on the market itself. Last year saw some frothy levels. I mean, a 20-fold advance. We don't see that every day. I know that really gets traders excited in something like Bitcoin and many of the altcoins, making that move look tame by comparison.
You know, I was as long Bitcoin as I was the euro last year. So to me, the fluidity of just accepting that I can be bullish on gold, I can be bullish on Bitcoin or Ethereum. And, you know, interestingly enough, we're going to see the Chicago Mercantile Exchange probably introduce an Ethereum futures contract probably this year, if not next. So that acceptance into more, you know, established exchanges like the Chicago Merc is happening. The single coin and the 5-coin Bitcoin futures contract, you know, a lot of people looked at that opportunity as an opportunity to hedge. So I love that there's more of a balanced view and traders are able to express their opinion on both sides, the crypto or even the currency, which to me crypto is an extension of that conversation. So You know, as far as I'm looking at the market at the moment, I know there's a lot of naysayers out there. We talk about the 2017, 2018 markets as being some of the most hated, and people love to cite the PE ratios of a lot of these names. And yet, when you look historically at the way in which PE ratios perhaps foretell any kind of significant downturn, they're absolutely lousy at it. So, you know, to me, right now, I think traders really should, if they can, invest in things that, one, they understand. I think a lot of times if Bitcoin or currencies are daunting, stick with things that make sense. I think right now there's wonderful plays in crude oil. And I think a lot of the oil services, Schlumberger, Exxon, Chevron, Halliburton, with the Permian Basin, the Eagle Ford, Eagle Ford Basin, there's a lot of investment into what's happening there. So there's opportunity absolutely across the board. So I love that we can jump from crypto to crude, and it's still about the opportunity that's there for traders and investors.
On crude oil, you know, West Texas, we were advising folks at 30 and 40 saying 70 minimum, and now revising 90 to 100 per barrel, and as well as in the precious metals that have been bottoming for a while. Something of a disconnect, I think you might agree, between the greenback and commodities.
Gold, I think at the moment, we need to exercise a little bit of patience. We've watched gold sink through 1300, and so I think there's going to be an opportunity here. I just want to wait to see where the U.S. dollar tops out. I think the timing for gold is going to coincide with expectations that the European Central Bank is ready to announce to the world that they're going to end the asset purchase program, that they're going to complete the tapering that they've already begun. And that's going to allow the dollar to simmer down. It's going to allow gold to find a floor and the euro. So I look at those three markets together in the way in which that gold bottom could form. So, you know, keep an eye on the ECB. I've actually been playing in the meanwhile. It's a little bit more trader oriented, but it's been a very consistent bounce around the 16 to 1620 level on silver. Today marks the fifth time that I've bought that zone, looking for a move up to about 1680 to 17. And then I'll look for the market to simmer down again. So if I'm an investor and I'm thinking long-term bullishly in gold, I don't have to get at, say, the 1680 or 17 level. I could just continue to accumulate every time we retest those lows. I'd like to see something similar in copper. So I think in the metal side of things, there's a lot of interesting opportunities for sort of patient traders and investors.
There are traders listening to our voices today. Nevertheless, the bulk of our folks are buy-in holders, long-term investors, and that's what we advocate and promote. And so, keeping with that theme, let's talk about the potential for retesting former highs in silver in the coming years, where we might head if gold were to break through that 14 to 1450 cap and the resistance we see there. Do you buy into the global inflation thesis that, you know, we've seen some signs of? I think you could make the case in the cryptos. People are moving away from currencies that are losing their purchasing power in favor of these cryptocurrencies.
When you look at what the central banks have had as their mandate now for a number of years, jobs and inflation have been a dual mandate for the U.S. and then pretty much every other central bank around the globe. It has been inflation. Hence, what I would not call a currency war, but certainly a race to the bottom, as so many of these central banks have embraced near zero, if not negative, interest rate policy. And while they don't want to tell the world that their inflation targets are met, because a lot, especially, for example, Europe, a weak euro continues to serve them. And so they know they've got to start hiking rates. I think inflation is here. But no central bank wants to admit it, because no central bank really aggressively wants to start hiking rates. So I think we're going to continue to see that dance play out when the reality is inflation targets are being met, but these central banks are going to continue to let those targets be overshot. I do think there's a path higher for gold, and it takes me right back to those central banks. It's right back to the ECB as far as I'm concerned. I am longer-term bullish gold. You know, if I were to step back and put on kind of more of a patience type, you know, mindset, that kind of view at gold at the moment, and I look at, say, a weekly chart, I look at the movement between about 1250 and 1400 as well within a range that we've seen since, you know, middle of last year. So that's really, in a longer term perspective, a wiggle that I'm willing to take. Wiggle meaning it might seem like a very wide range, but on our way to 1,400 and quite frankly beyond. I have targets even longer term that are just above 1,500, going to need these central banks to kind of help out. That strong dollar is going to continue to be a weight, but that strong dollar cannot, I'm looking at about a 12-month to 16-month timeline to when the ECB's hand's going to be forced to really start messaging to the market that they have to hike rates, and that's when I think we'll start to see that gold market move.
Why don't you direct the conversation to anything else you think our listeners might be interested in today?
Sure. Yeah, right now I'm working on my fourth book, which is really going to be a book on what I feel is going to be more simple to use technical analysis. That's something that I focus on with my side project over at a site called simplertrading.com, which is making a lot of fusing aspects of market analysis, whether that be fundamental, technical, short-term, or long-term, as many of my members at the site like to call it, sort of a paint-by-numbers approach. How do we simplify these things and make them more understandable? And, you know, and part of that is waiting for certain criteria to be met. You bring up a great point. You know, I think to rush the markets into doing something they're not ready to do, it's such a disservice to most investors and traders, because if I imply a certain amount of impatience in a trade, I can't give them the patience they need in order to execute their trading plans and their investing plans. And there is a lot of power in time. There is a lot of power in patience. So, you know, for me, macro patience, you know, speed for my analysis, speed to change my mind. But once I've got that plan, really just step back and let it play out. Find me at simplertrading.com.
Well, it can't be any simpler than that. Please return to the show.
Would be my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome, Bix Weir.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Great to have you. And you know, you brought up EOS, Dan Larimer, and Brock Pierce, two key developers, core developers. Cardano, fascinating idea, and also run by an ex-Ethereum developer, one of the early OGs in Ethereum. Both unique and promising. Keep an eye on the Solidity language. This has just opened up possibilities, a whole new realm of potential. I mean, relative to Bitcoin, Ethereum is more like a Jeep, a Hummer, and it's solid, but there are a lot of attack vectors because it's a more of a contract open source as opposed to Bitcoin, which is intended as a store of value.
I think Satoshi had a very different idea for Bitcoin as a peer-to-peer cash system. So it was the core developers that moved it away from that into the store of value, which is, you're 100% correct. It is now very few vectors to attack Bitcoin compared to everything else. But it wasn't originally planned that way.
There's even, ironically, a crypto tulip. Create your own version of a tulip, and it's immediately uploaded onto the Ethereum blockchain, and then you have rights to your own specific tulip. Okay, it's gimmicky, but this is a game changer. Moving on, we were talking in the pre-show chat about some of the other areas that people might have the wrong initial first impression on the cryptos. And I think you pointed out that this is earlier days than most people realize. Just because there's competition to Bitcoin and Ethereum does not negate their value. In other words, we're probably not going to wake up tomorrow, are we, and find that Bitcoin has collapsed because there were better core developers. It doesn't mean we can't just have an IBM, a Microsoft, and an Apple. You can have many different competitors within a certain space.
Well, I think the argument for the scarcity factor is that there's so many forks of Bitcoin, there's so many other cryptocurrencies, it takes away the value, it takes away the premise that Bitcoin is not a scarce asset because there's all kinds of new things springing up from it. I don't believe that at all. I think there's plenty of room for all types of crypto assets in the world, just like there's room for all types of assets in like foreign exchanges, all different types of money, all different types of stocks and bonds and derivatives. And if you really want to make that argument, there can be only one thing that works, and it is Bitcoin, as some of the Bitcoin purists say. I think that is the most ridiculous thing in the world. And it depends where you want to use it and how you want to use it. So a lot of these new altcoins and cryptocurrencies are specifically designed for a specific business case. a use case within a business process. And I think that's where we get into some really cool stuff, because these tokens act more like a means of exchange in the barter system. For all you monetary historians out there, it's always said that, you know, gold is not the perfect money, but it's the best we got. Because barter doesn't work, because a home builder can't trade with a bread baker. Well, if we tokenize homes and we tokenize bread, perhaps it is can function even more closely to that barter system than just an overall here's money and everything has to be transferred into money. So I think that Bitcoin purists were wrong to say it can only be Bitcoin. I think those that say the cryptos, there's so many of them, the scarcity problem is, you know, scarcity is not solved. I think they're both wrong. I think there's room for all kinds of things going on in the middle, just like there is today with every other asset type.
So I'll start off with AOL. Okay, how does AOL, how does America Online tie in? You know, it helps to be the first one on the block, to have that name recognition, to have that first mover advantage, as they refer to it. And AOL had that. And ironically, even today, I have some close friends, family members, who still embrace AOL, not because it's the best, not because it's the fastest, not frankly because they should be paying for the platform at all, or using it for that matter, but because it's an old pair of pajamas. They started off with over 20 years ago and still use today. And again, Bitcoin, that first mover advantage, widely disseminated in a similar fashion. AOL, of course, they were handing out tens of millions of free CDs to get people hooked, to get them started. Key core developers are taking us in many unique directions.
I think we are quickly, as in probably this summer, moving into a more retail focus for the cryptos. And I think it'll be necessary with the problems in our banking system, especially if we have another 2008 event come the end of this year. But I think that's the key for cryptos coming up, is really get that retail use case out there. Get it so that people can go to their Starbucks and use Litecoin or Dash or Bitcoin or whatever they want based on what they want to choose. And we get it into the retailers, the large retailers like Amazon. There's all kinds of rumors about that.
Amazon, they've actually purchased up the rights. It's something along the lines of Amazon Ethereum and other blockchain names and domains.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And, I mean, these are in the technology business. They see it coming. You can't deny it anymore. All the deniers are basically now either have an agenda, a reason for denying, or they're just so stuck in their ways that it would be too embarrassing to change their mind. That the crypto universe, the blockchain is coming, the cryptocurrencies are coming, and the main reason that everybody kind of forgets, it's not that, you know, the cryptos are fully built out and so strong and trustworthy.
Using Japan as the test case, if you will, the test bed, this is an entrenched economic system where the needs of the many are watched, I think, much more carefully than in the West. Japan has recently made Bitcoin legal tender. What do they see that our policymakers and legislators don't see? In other words, given that they were the initiators of quantitative easing way back in the 90s, and they saw that that didn't go too well for their economy, and they might be recognizing it's not going too well either for the dominant global economy here, and maybe not so well for their neighbors next door. Perhaps they see a fiat money crisis, and that's why virtually every shop is starting to accept or consider accepting crypto, Bitcoin, and alternative altcoins as legal tender, as a means of exchange, as a means to purchase food, clothing.
I think you're absolutely correct, and we'll see more and more of it. The cryptos are being brought to humanity as a way out of the old system. It will be there. It'll be up and running by the time. But right now, it is so much stronger than it was. You know, if you go back to 2008, right before Bitcoin, the white paper was released, and we had the financial crisis, the only reason the banks got bailed out was because the death and destruction it would have caused if they weren't bailed out. We had no other place to go. Now we do. We do have another place to go. And that is the whole concept behind the cryptocurrencies, behind Bitcoin. And this goes back way long before the release of the Satoshi white paper. I've done quite a bit of work going back to the beginnings of computer programming. And who put the software in our hands and who put the hardware in our hands, they were all participants in this white paper, ultimately culminating in the, at the end of 2008. This was based on years' worth of work, decades' worth of work, hardware and software. We needed the cell phones in our hands to have something like Bitcoin work. And absolutely, the guy who basically put the personal computer in our houses and put the cell phones in our hands was involved with Bitcoin in the early days.
Yeah, the cypherpunks, their roots really go back to, I mean, arguably the late 70s, early 80s.
That's what the Roto-Rooter theory is the plan was to destroy the monetary system because there was an economic paper written in the 1960s called On the Road to the Golden Age. And in that, it was a Nobel Prize winning paper. In that, they said the best way to return to a gold standard is to run the unbacked fiat system as long and hard as possible, soaking up all the benefits, and just crash it because you print too much money.
You know, the Glass-Steagall Act removed, ushering in this period of unrivaled financial derivatives leverage that we hadn't seen since the 1920s. And of course, we all know how that ended. Fast forward to today, and this bubble defies bubble physics. I think even Stephen Hawking would be astounded at the level of growth we've seen since his untimely passing. So you kind of see that as our next Lehman moment, our Bear Stearns, that was really more or less a couple of the tipping points that led us into the 2008-2009 Great Recession. The Great Recession just looms in the back of my mind. Paulson, you know, the former Treasury Secretary, and so many of his colleagues behind the scenes, under their breath, say, we were minutes, hours away.
We had a Congressman Kudzorski come on C-SPAN and say, we were literally hours from everything ending. Unless we gave the banks $700 billion and free rein to leverage it up to $20 trillion, everybody would have lost every financial asset they owned, and it would have been mass chaos, so we made the decision to bail out the banks. Now, the question today is, will they make that same decision? Have the people learned enough to say no more bailouts, even though it causes mass chaos? I think we have. And I even think... I would go a little deeper that they set it up so that there won't be in the Dodd-Frank law. They added at the last second that the FDIC has to bail out the derivative holders before they bail out any savings or checking account. So that basically guaranteed no bailout will happen.
I have, I think, two camps of guests here. One group, they say it'll be the same as it's been in the past. They will massage the system. They have so many tricks up their sleeves. They can manipulate the interest rates, which I think is more questionable now. A new level of quantitative easing. That's sort of the old guard economist retort, if you will. Then there's the others who say there's nothing that can be done. It's going to be a complete global reset. They're going to have to lop two or three digits off of the dollar.
The biggest problem is misallocation of money. You lop two or three digits off the dollar, everybody's in the exact same place they were before, except two or three digits is gone. So it would not solve any problem. It wouldn't get rid of the derivatives. Where I think we are is that the people who are really in charge, the people who have the mouse that can click it and destroy the system, have been trying to set up this crypto system so that when they do click that mouse and they do end the banking system, there will be somewhere else to go. And that for a long time was missing.
Wouldn't you say that's really the prime directive of Satoshi Nakamoto's now seminal paper? This was right around that time where, at least according to legend, Satoshi had just suffered some really serious financial losses.
I think Satoshi had in mind, I want to give humanity an alternative, not because I lost money, but because I have seen over the past 100 years that we had had no way out of this system that we put in place in 1913.
I'm sure you remember Friedman's classic comments that we have email, we have the internet, and now all we need is an e-cash way back in 1999. Tim Drape that Bitcoin would hit 10,000 in 2018. There is an invisible hand behind this market, and he alludes to that, and you just did as well. But there is a groundswell of really forward-thinking individuals, many of whom might be MKUltra survivors, I don't know, targeted individuals. But it seems to be a group of people that have rejected the old guard, the previous system, and they want to usher in a more benevolent structure.
I would take it one deeper step and say that group that controls the price is within the U.S. government. The new $100 bill on the left side is all green, just like the old $100 bill. The right side's full of gold. And it says you have the right to overthrow your government in gold right above the 100. This is absolutely a plan going on to remove the banking cabal, shall we say, from controlling our lives.
The typical person, family today, household, has really less than $500. On average, most reports, something like 75 to 80% of American households report they couldn't put together $1,000 in an emergency other than borrowing it against their credit cards. How does that work out well?
Two concepts. When you say that, you know, the average American can't put together any money, that's absolutely true. But the government takes a big chunk of, so you could put together more money if there were no taxes. The other big component is the debt component. Everybody in the United States is massively in debt. So if you strip away the banks, you're stripping away the debt too. And there won't be this tax thing that we have because all the debt will be gone. So it really can, it won't be smooth. Absolutely no. There will be chaos, there will be death. But it would be a lot worse had the cryptos not come around. But that was always the plan, is to, going back to this 1960s, you know, report called On the Road to the Golden Age, the only way to get back to a gold standard, a sound monetary system at the time, is to destroy the unbacked fiat system. And that's what Greenspan taking away regulation on derivatives was all about, giving the banks enough rope to hang themselves. And that's what they've done, creating this derivative bubble.
Well, how can Bitcoin be relevant at $8,000 or $9,000? How can Ethereum be worth $400 or $500 or $1,000? You know, the retail investors, Bix, only had access to the latter stages of the underwriting process, didn't they? I mean, you had the major houses, the JP Morgans, the Goldman's underwriters, gave shares to their most prized whale clients, if you will, in their brokerages, in their investment houses. And those clients, those institutions, they received for pennies on the dollar. You know, we're soaring 100%, 200%, 300% on the opening day, and sometimes continued from there, as Google did. For the first time in history, hasn't this crypto revolution started on Main Street instead of Wall Street, which handed the underwriting reins, if you will, to John and Jill Public?
As far as like the IPO versus ICO, who's allowed to invest, yeah, that was a huge deal. That's why the SEC is trying to crack down on the ICOs now, calling them securities. They want only their people that pay their salaries and, you know, pay their politicians to have first crack at these companies that are being created through the blockchain. They're going to do it in the name of protecting the investor. All it really does is take these great opportunities and gives them back to the, you know, their cronies. And I've been fighting that, but it's, you know, it's like screaming into the wind when you're yelling at the government. At the same time, it's like, yes, this is humanity breaking free. And now they want in. That's the cool thing, is these banksters and hedge funds and mutual funds all want in the cryptos, but they don't know how to get in because it's so illiquid. It's such a tiny market. That's why you're going to see valuations just go through the roof. But also, people have to remember that most cryptocurrencies are not, you're not evaluating a company. The term market cap is kind of misleading. All it means is the amount of tokens or coins circulating times the last price. Doesn't mean someone went out and spent $100 billion on a coin. It could be, you know, one coin for $100 billion, yeah, or it could be a billion coins for $1 or $100, and that would be have the same market cap. So by calling it market cap, it confuses people. But also, this isn't ownership in a company for most of these cryptos. What it is the money being used within a certain business environment on the altcoins. Or with the cryptocurrencies like Litecoin and Bitcoin, it is the money that is replacing the old corrupt money of fiat dollars and fiat yuan, euro, whatever. So all kinds of concepts could be brought up there, but it ultimately is humanity breaking free.
Why don't you tell people a little bit more about Road to Ruta?
YouTube is kind of a new thing for me. I only started about a year and a half ago, and it's just taken off, which is great. But I've been writing... I've had the Road to Ruta website up since 2010. Before that, I was working with Bill Murphy at Le Metropole Cafe and Gata in the early days, going back to 2000 is when I started this fight. So Yeah, on the Road to Ruta website, there's thousands of articles about this stuff and really proving what's going on in my mind and anybody who's taking the time that there is a secret plot going on behind the scenes, and it's good for humanity.
Talk soon.
All right, take care.
It's a pleasure to welcome on his debut appearance, the president and CEO of Eagle Plains Resources Limited, Tim Termundi. His firm is a mineral explorer located in Western Canada. Eagle Plains Resources seeks deposits of precious metals, base metals, uranium, rare earths, and industrial metals, enhancing shareholder value through acquisition and development of early stage mineral exploration projects. Welcome to Gold Seek Radio, Mr. Termundi.
Thanks very much for having me, Chris. Excited to tell the story.
In your literature, it notes a project generator. This is a risk-averse business model, and you build symbiotic relationships with partner companies to advance exploration. This really caught my attention while preparing for today's interview. Partners fund exploration as well as make cash and share payments to the benefit of Eagle Plains Resources shareholders in order to earn an interest in an Eagle Plains project. Now, a key component of the Eagle Plains business model is clearly its spin-out of interest of any project into a new company. For instance, Eagle Plains has a proposed spin-out, Taiga Gold Corp. Could you give us some details, please, on this very interesting project?
Yeah, I guess essentially, going back to the project generator model, we've been around as a public company for 22 years, trading as a public company, And we're basically working on the riskiest part of the mining spectrum. We're the explorers. We're the guys that are doing grassroots work, trying to basically make something from nothing in a broad landscape. So we found over the years that the only way to do that, because it is so risky, because you have to kiss a lot of frogs in this business, that the way to succeed and to survive is to spread the risk around. And so a long time ago, we said, you know what, we don't need 100% of a discovery to be successful. We just need a portion of it. And so by identifying areas that we like or projects that we like, we get them cheap to next to nothing acquisition costs, usually by staking, sometimes with a deal with prospectors for shares or a small amount of cash that basically gets us in the door on a project. And then we add our geological expertise. We've got a very strong team of geologists and geotechs, and we add our input to move these projects along. And then, you know, we might spend $100,000 or a couple $100,000 doing early testing, maybe a drill hole or two to show if this model comes together. And then we try and attract another partner to come in and carry the load. And we've done that quite successfully over the years. And when these other partners come in, they earn an interest in our property. We have 100% at the start, and then they are earning in an interest. So it might be 50%, 60%, 80%. It depends how the deal is structured. But we basically hand off the risk, the bigger risk, the more expensive part of the exploration process to another company. And in doing so, they are earning into the property. As part of these earn-ins, they usually give us some cash or shares as well along the way as kind of rental payments, if you will. And, those go to the benefit of our shareholders. We use the funds from these cash and shares to basically pick up more projects, to spread out and do more and basically amplify our efforts in exploration. Every now and then, a project sort of takes a life of its own. It becomes successful. It becomes sort of gets to that next tier that it may be an early resource definition or a something of very great interest is found. And at that point, we spin that project out into a separate company. We create another company that is owned by Eagle Plains initially, and then that company becomes dividended out to Eagle Plains shareholders. We've done it very successfully in the past with Copper Canyon Resources. Back in 2011, Copper Canyon, which was spun out from Eagle Plains, was taken over by our partner, by NovaGold, and that was a $65 million windfall for our shareholders. We've done it a couple times since then in other companies, other spin-outs, and right now we are in the process of spinning out Taiga Gold Corp, which contains our flagship gold project called the Fisher property in Saskatchewan. Fisher is being drilled right now by Silver Standard. They have two drills on site, and they are working on a 60,000-foot drill program that they'll complete throughout the year this year.
It seems as though your firm is somewhat of an incubator for interesting projects that show promise. Is that a fair assessment at all?
That's a brilliant assessment. That's perfectly accurate. We're an incubator. We give birth to these projects, and we advance them, nurture them, and then bring in another company or another partner to help, you know, spend the bigger bucks to prove or disprove, you know, whether there's something there or not. Again, it's a very risky business, so, you know, you have to, you know, get used to drilling dry holes or dusters or holes that don't come up the way you'd like them to do, and that's part of the process of exploration. You have to find out where it isn't first to find out where it is, and, you know, it is basically spreading that risk around.
I like to hear that, because not only are you being forthright with the potential and inherent risks, fully transparent there, but it also, I think, gives the layperson, there will be plenty of folks that are just new to the whole concept of mining and exploration today, a better feel for the overall mission. All right, moving on, the flagship property, a spin out, that is the Fisher Project. On March of 20th, you announced that you have an option partner with a major miner, SSR Mining, formerly Silver Standard. I know many folks will be familiar.
Yeah, the spin-out effectively acts as a dividend to our shareholders. When we spun out Copper Canyon, originally in 2006, an Eagle Plains shareholder got a full share of Copper Canyon. So you kept your share of Eagle Plains, which incidentally didn't even really significantly go down after the spin-out. It stayed where it was. Copper Canyon opened at $1 a share. So basically all our shareholders were thrilled. They got a share of Copper Canyon showed up in their brokerage account, and it was essentially a free share. So as we do these spin-outs, that's kind of the way the dividend works. And with Taiga, the spin-out we're doing right now, which is underway and almost completed, an Eagle Plains shareholder will get a half a share of Taiga for every share of Eagle Plains. So two shares of Eagle Plains will generate one share of Taiga. And that share essentially acts as a tax-free dividend. It just shows up in their accounts. It'll have its own value. I don't know what the value is. The market will determine that. But until that share is sold, there's no tax effect either. So it effectively acts as a significant dividend to our shareholders. So there's really no downside to this method that we're employing right now. It just creates upside for shareholders in general. Again, for us, by having SSR Mining or Silver Standard funding the exploration of this big drill program, the 18,000-meter drill program, there's zero risk to Eagle Plains. So we've managed to de-risk a particularly risky side of this business.
Your business model there actually mirrors what we're seeing in the cryptosphere today. The airdrop concept, company tokens might be distributed to a current account, you might say in an efficient manner that minimizes tax implications. And another component of the Eagle Plains Project Generator is your goal of earning royalties on properties that have been vended to third parties. Currently, Eagle Plains maintains royalties on 15 projects held by junior and senior mining and exploration companies.
A few of our projects over the years, we've either done these option deals where a company can earn 50, 60, 80%, or we've sold them outright to certain companies. When we do these outright sales, we usually get some shares in the other company, maybe some cash, keep a royalty, a 1 or 2% royalty, so that in the event that these projects turn into any producing commercial operation, we get a royalty on any of the proceeds from that. We managed to do deals with some big companies, and especially in the uranium space, we've got royalties with Cameco, with Denison Mines, with ALX, with Areva. So these are basically just projects in the back burner, don't cost us anything to maintain. We have zero maintenance of these projects, but if they ever turn into anything, these royalties can be worth a lot of money. They're basically just one of the things we have cooking in the background while we're doing our exploration on other projects. So it's a way to take non-core assets and still have them tickets in the lottery drum sort of thing for us going forward.
All right, Eagle Plains has many other properties and partners earning on options arrangements.
Right now, we've got three or four option deals currently underway. The most important one is obviously the Fisher property that SSR Mining has. We've also got a deal on our Chico property with Abin Resources, a deal on our Acacia property, which is a volcanogenic massive sulfide project in central BC. We've got that with CRC Metals. It's been quiet the last few years as far as doing property deals, just as a result of the general downturn of the mining industry. But back in 2011, we had 24 deals going at one time. Each one of these option deals had another company spending money promoting the project, giving us cash and shares. That year in 2011, we saw almost $10 million in exploration spending on our properties, and we spent out of our treasury only about $500,000 that year. So we had roughly $10 million in exploration, a bunch of cash and shares coming in. And so that's when the project generator model was in hyperdrive. We were going as hard as we could, and we'd like to get to that stage someday. We've the downturn to acquire a lot of projects at fire sale prices. We're ready for the next mining cycle, which we think is coming. We think it's imminent. It's been five or six pretty rough years for most people in the industry, but we've managed to basically capitalize on that by picking up assets when people either couldn't afford to keep them or just couldn't afford to do the research to find them. So we've been active throughout the downturn. We haven't had a reduction in staff. We've kept our staff intact and used that resource to be ready for this next cycle.
Well, a hat tip for thriving in a very difficult climate. Earlier this year, on January 31st, Eagle Plains Resources acquired new claims at the Knife Lake area near Sandy Bay, Saskatchewan. Could you tell us more facts on this project?
Yeah, it's just a good example of being counter-cyclical, I think. We've been researching, again, as I mentioned, throughout the downturn. We've been sort of eyeing things we like and just waiting to see if they'll come open or come available for staking or whatever. And this Knife Lake area is a good example of that. It's a project that saw a lot of work in the late 1990s, early 2000, had over 500 drill holes put into it and preliminary resource put together of roughly 20 million tons of copper equivalent at about 1%. It's a bona fide deposit. It's had a lot of work done on it. And remarkably, last fall, it came open for staking. And it's just an example when things get that tough, projects like that sort of float to the surface. And that's what we were able to acquire. We're still working on it right now. We're compiling all the data, but I think people will hear a lot more about Knife Lake as we go forward. It's an example sort of like Copper Canyon. When we picked up the Copper Canyon property, it was coming off a very, very tough downturn in the business. And remarkably, those Copper Canyon claims came open years ago. So we see history repeating itself right now with the situation we're in. And we're hoping we can capitalize on it and reward our shareholders for sticking with us.
Well, listeners are encouraged to determine if Eagle Plains Resources Limited, this is, of course, is a favorite portfolio candidate of Peter Spina, our hot shot gold and silver stock analyst. So see if it's a good fit for their portfolio. Ticker symbol can be found on the TSX Venture Exchange under EPL. Tim, it's been a delight hearing you outline all the key developments at Eagle Plains Resources. We hope you'll find time to return to the show in the coming months with the latest updates on this exciting venture.
All right. Thanks very much, Chris. Thanks for having me.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. When you buy software, access a healthcare portal, visit a website, or sign up for something online, do you ever bother to read the terms of service that govern those agreements you enter into whenever you participate in such activity? Terms of service, privacy policies, and disclaimers make for fascinating reading. Yes, they are often in small type, hard to find, but they are there. Those documents spell out the countless clauses that rule your life. These rules that govern so many aspects of our lives are not written or passed by Congress. They are written by nameless corporate lawyers and organizational administrators whose goal is not to look after you, but rather to protect them. If you've ever had a problem with a credit card or credit bureau, did you take it upon yourself to actually read the Fair Credit Reporting Act? Or did you rely on someone else's interpretation of what that document actually says, in lieu of reading it yourself? It's available online. Have you ever read the IRS Field Audit Manual, the Affordable Care Act, the Plum Book, the fine print on your SLV or GLD shares, if in fact you own such an instrument? How about when you visit a healthcare provider and they ask you to sign that little digital screen for patient privacy, financial responsibility, and other terms and conditions, but you cannot see the document? all you can do is sign the little screen. And when you do, you have no idea what you have just agreed to. The next time that happens, try asking for a printed copy of what you're signing and see how quickly you foul up their workflow. The sad truth is, we agree to things each day we don't know about or don't understand. We give our freedom and privacy away every day, and often don't even realize what we have lost. When was the last time you actually read the Constitution or the Bill of Rights? Probably around the same time you read those updated terms of service at your bank or doctor's office. The world we think we live in is very different from the world we actually live in. Everything may seem to be going according to plan until it doesn't. That's when you'll be referred to your terms of service and discover how little recourse you actually have. It may be hard, it may be boring, but get informed and stay informed. Your success and your protection depend on it. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. Thank you.
Thank you.